Well, good afternoon, everyone. It's nice to see you all. This is the third installment of the Career Advancement Toolkits, the industry section. Today, we're going to be talking about interviewing outside the ivory tower. How many of you have ever been on an interview? And we're not talking postdoc interviews, like a real interview. Oh, less hands. Did you find it different than any kind of interview you've ever had in the past? There's a lot of questions that you typically get asked in an interview that don't happen so much in a postdoc interview or a grad school interview that hopefully we'll shed some light on today. We have two fantastic speakers today. I'm really thrilled to host Libby Mansell and Eric Nelson. Libby is the president and CEO, I imagine, of White Oak Biopharma Solutions. Libby's worked for a long time in various sizes of pharmaceutical companies. She is a pharmacokineticist. She has a PhD and an MBA, right? So she has both. So for those of you who are thinking about doing the dual degrees, can hit her up later. I met her through this very wonderful group called Healthcare Business Women's Association, which I always mess up as well. It's a fantastic group of industry ladies who do science, and they're going to be coming to the NIH to talk more about opportunities for women in science and in industry in January. So we're pleased to have Libby today, and Eric Nelson is the Director of Human Resources at MedImmune, just up the street, a division of AstraZeneca now, and he's been there for 4.5 years. So I'm going to give you a little bit about how the flow of today is going to go, so you know a little bit of what to expect. Eric's going to talk a little bit about the hiring process and how interviews fit into that hiring process. Libby's going to talk a little bit about how to prepare and what to expect in different types of interviews. And this is a very, very open format. We want you all to feel free to come up and ask questions at any time. Because we are video casting, we do ask that you try to use the microphones. And if you don't, we will be repeating your question so that everyone can hear it. And we're also going to do a mock interview where I am going to channel my inner postdoc and pretend to be a postdoc again and answer the questions as if I were in your shoes. I vaguely remember my postdoc days. And for those of you who don't know me, I am Lori Conlon, the Director of the Office of Postdoctoral Services here at the NIH. I see a lot of friendly faces out there I know, so I'm glad you all could be here today. So anything before we get started? All right, well, then I'm going to invite Eric up to the podium first to discuss the hiring process. And again, remember, you can ask any questions at any time. We're a pretty friendly group up here. So, Eric?
Right here?
Yes.
Okay, great.
And then this is the laser pointer.
Got it. Okay. Thank you, Lori. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm happy to be here. It's been fun working with Lori and Libby in preparation for today. And as Lori said, we hope that when we're finished here, you'll have a better feel for the hiring process, a better feel for interviewing specifically, as you get ready or perhaps are already in the process as you are nearing the end of your current stage. Well, the hiring process does have several steps. It may be self-evident, but we thought it'd be a good idea to walk through it just to give you an idea of, if you apply for a job, what happens to the information that you submit, or what happens after you've talked with somebody at the employer or after you've submitted a resume. So the first, obviously, is the employer posts a vacant position. A fair amount of thought goes into that because we have to decide what exactly do we really need, what are we looking for in filling this job. You may notice, and I'm speaking particularly from an industry point of view here, sometimes jobs are posted kind of dual level. Oh, this is a scientist 1/2. That gives a company leeway in selecting the people that they interview. Some may come with more experience, some with less, and so they would fit into a particular level. So if you see that, You'll apply for the job. The actual decision about you and where you might fit in that level then will be based, of course, on your own experience and what you bring to the job. The next, then, let's say you find a job you're interested in and you want to apply. Almost always these days, you're going to be asked to apply online. We seldom see letters with resumes in them anymore. Just the online process makes it easier to handle the volume of resumes. You might go through a recruiter. Anyone here been contacted by recruiters yet or in touch with any recruiters? So I see a few hands. So that may be your avenue into a company. You may network. Anyone started networking here yet? People you know that might already be at a company or in an academic institution that might be a door in for you. That is probably the most effective way that you're going to find a job, and there may be talking about networking some of your other seminars and such, but if you haven't started that, I suggest you look into networking. However, networking does not obviate the need to actually apply to a company. Companies have, and other institutions have, legal requirements as far as applications, and so they want to see you apply formally so that they can enter you into their applicant tracking and other databases. The next is the first decision point for the employer, and that is reviewing resumes. That's going to be the first thing usually that they're going to see with regard to who you are and what you have to offer. That's why it's important, we'll talk about this a little bit more, that your resume needs to make an impact. I'm sure you've talked about resume writing. We'll just talk about it a little bit more, not so much the writing of it, but what you need to pay attention to. But at this point, the company makes its first decision about its candidate pool. That is, am I going to continue with Joe or am I not going to continue with Joe? And that may be as far as a given candidate gets, again, based on their background and such. Before we move to this, though, is to give a little bit more thought to what goes on your resume. I don't know if you've talked about this, but I still want to highlight it because I see too often in interviews people obviously aren't prepared to talk about some of the qualifications for the job. When you look at a job description, usually at the beginning it talks about, oh, this job will be working in, you know, designing and conducting experiments in oncology research, and this person needs to know this or needs to know that. A lot of times that's where candidates stop. Oh, that's exactly what I've been doing in my postdoc. I'm a shoo-in for this job. But what you need to do is make sure you read all the way through. I went to some of our job postings at MedImmune, and some of it says, some of them say, individual is expected to present data in group and project team meetings. Candidate must possess excellent oral and written presentation skills. Expected to be an independent problem solver. Work effectively in a team environment. Excellent interpersonal skills. Those don't necessarily have anything to do with your area of scientific study, but they have a lot to do with how successful you might be in a work setting. So what you need to do is, however you can, present those qualifications on your resume as well, because you'll be asked questions about that in an interview, and we'll talk about that in just a little bit more. So the interview process. And you've submitted your resume. The employer says, this candidate looks promising. I think we'd like to learn a little bit more about them. You might start out with a phone interview. That is usually with the hiring manager, although sometimes it may be with someone from human resources. At MedImmune, it's our hiring managers that perform the phone interviews. They're usually about 30 to 45 minutes. And this is the second decision point in the process for those who do phone interviews. So our advice here is, do not take phone interviews lightly. They are a real interview, and there's no guarantee that you'll go any further after a phone interview, because it is indeed a selection point or a decision point. You need to prepare yourself before the phone interview. Know what the job is, know what the company is about and what they're doing, and knowing what you think you want to say in a phone interview. You need to place yourself in the right environment. Do not do a phone interview while you're in the lab running an experiment. Do not do a phone interview on a cell phone when you're walking across campus or driving home. And what you want to do is find a place that's private and that's quiet where you can concentrate and give your full attention to the phone interview, because you want to pass that. Usually if you pass a phone interview, you will be invited in for an on-site interview. They may invite you right there on the phone. They may get back to you. But again, it's important. Don't take it too lightly. The next then is the on-site interview. This is a definite sign that the employer is interested in you. So this is your opportunity to show what you can bring to that employer. It's also an opportunity for you to get to know each other. And we really want to focus on, it's not a one-way activity. It's not just the employer getting to know who you are. It's your opportunity to get to know the employer. What's the culture like? What are the people like? What's the work really about there? Those sorts of things. So keep that in mind, and again, we'll talk about that a little bit more. You want to know as much as you can about the job, about the company, and about yourself. You need to be able to talk about yourself. You need to be able to demonstrate how you have performed in various settings. So do not wing the interview. You need to prepare, spend time preparing before you go on the interview. One model that some interviewers use is a 3C model, which stands for capability, commitment, and chemistry. Commitment meaning, can you do the job? Commitment is, do you want to do the job, and will you do the job if hired? And the third is chemistry, also known as fit, which is, will the employer be able to stand you while you're doing the job? And that's also very important. But the fit works both ways. Is that a place that you want to be, where you want to spend your time? The interviewer, as I talked about, the interview is two ways. The interviewer controls the questions. You control the content, because you're responding to those questions. Important thing to remember. That's what I mean by preparing. And when Libby talks about questions, they're a great example of the kinds of questions you might see and what you're going to want to prepare to answer before you go to your interview. So in an interview, it's not okay to give a yes or a no answer. Did you enjoy lunch? Yes, that's certainly okay. But anything that's of real content in the interview, don't give it just a yes or no answer. Even if you're asked a yes or a no question, don't give a yes or a no answer. You can expound on things. You give an answer, you say to a question, have you ever worked in a difficult team setting? Yes. Or you could say, yes, as a matter of fact, and then you can give an example. That's what they want to hear. Some interviewers ask yes or no questions, which is really something they shouldn't be doing. But if you get one, don't just give a yes or no answer. Be able to give examples of what you've accomplished and examples of how you've demonstrated the qualifications of the position. That's where the preparation comes in. There's a model called a STAR model. Stands for situation, task, action, results. I know that Lori uses a similar model. I think she has a different acronym for it, but it's basically the same thing. And if you go in prepared with examples based on that model, you can show what you've actually done. You don't want to speak hypothetically in an interview. Well, if I were in that situation, this is what I would do. Or, well, I think in that kind of a situation, you would want to do this. You don't want to give answers like that. Speak about yourself. Speak about what you've done and be able to give examples of the things you've done. And again, it's not just about the science that you've been spending so much of your time on. You may very well be asked a question about how to have you work in a difficult team setting, or give me an example of a successful presentation that you made. And you can speak to those and give examples. You need to be succinct and thorough. Don't ramble. But give a thorough answer. And it's okay to stop and think a bit before you give an answer to a question. If you're not quite sure how you want to frame your answer, don't feel pressured to just start talking. Just give it a thought. Most interviewers understand that you want to pull your thought together about a question. It's also okay to ask clarifying questions. If you don't understand what they're asking you, or you want to make sure maybe you could interpret it more than one way, it's okay to ask and ask them to clarify the question. So you make sure that you're answering the question that was asked. One thing that's frustrating to interviewers is to have a candidate not answer the question that was asked. So make sure that you know what they're looking for. You need to go prepared with questions of your own. This is getting back to that idea of it's a two-way street. This is a chance for you to get to know the employer. A candidate, when asked if they have questions, who says, no, not really, comes across as either disinterested or uninformed. And neither of those will be to your benefit in a selection decision by the employer. So you need to decide, what do you want to know about this organization? What's the culture like? What is the job really about? Who would you be working with? What does it take to be successful in that organization? Lots of things I'm sure you're going to be interested in, so go prepared with your questions and be ready to ask those. Most interviewers will give you time to ask questions. It's important for you to do that. You may have to give a presentation, a scientific presentation at MedImmune. All of our science level positions, candidates do give a one-hour presentation about some of the research that they have done. So again, this is your opportunity. If you read those MedImmune, for example, job postings, and it talks about excellent oral and written presentation skills, you're going to be judged there, not just on your science, you're going to be judged as well on your presentation skills and your interaction as people ask questions during your presentation. So you'll need to be ready to do the best job that you can there as well. So the next step is the decision process. This is the third decision point and the final decision point for the employer. They will be assessing the interviews, making the decisions. Usually they will have some sort of a rating template that they use so they can compare and contrast different candidates. This is also the time, though, for you as a candidate to assess the interview and make your decision. Is that a place that you want to work? Is that a job that seems interesting to you now that you've had a chance to talk about it? Those sorts of things. So you should be doing that as well. This process can be very quick and can also take a while, depending on who the employer is. Some organizations are known to be pretty quick. Some organizations are known to drag their feet a little bit, and that can be frustrating, but that may be the way it is. And it may, you know, it's usually okay if it's taking some time just to touch bases, find out where the process is at, that sort of thing, if you do run into that. Remember, it's important, too, in these positions, probably all of them that I think that you would be vying for, is that you're competing with a national candidate pool. So, we're looking across the country, outside the country possibly as well, for the best candidates that we can find. So it's important to remember that as well. The next step then after the decision, the hiring manager makes a decision. It's usually going to be vetted with his or her management before the final decision is made. A job offer is put out. I do understand you'll be talking about the job offer process at a later seminar, so we're not going to talk a lot about that. Just want to talk about, you know, when you receive an offer, I would suggest you don't need to rush into anything. I mean, the employer wants to know, but they don't need to know the second that they offer it to you. So you'll need to think about it. You may come back with a counteroffer. You may decide to accept it. You may decide to decline. But that's an important step for you as you go forward. I know that Lori said you'll be talking about that some more. And last is the onboarding process. Once an offer has been accepted and a start date has been established, the employer will conduct a background check on you. They'll look at things like criminal record and, you know, that sort of thing, as well as other employment that you've had, that sort of information. Usually you'll have at least a drug screen. If you're working in the lab, you'll most likely have a physical as well. There may be relocation that's applicable, so you'll need to understand the employer's relocation policy, how it applies to you, what it means, and then the various things about getting started, start date, onboarding, and all of those as well. So that's just a quick run through of the hiring process. As we go forward, we're going to be talking more about interviewing. I know there'll be opportunities for questions. I would, if it's okay, ask if there are any questions at this point from anything that I've said. There's one.
I just wanted to ask about the telephone interview. What type of questions would you be asked at that stage?
More preliminary questions. This is with regard to the telephone interview, what kinds of questions would be asked. Most likely they're going to try to get into a little more depth to understand your resume, to make sure they understand the kinds of research that you have done, the kinds of experiences that you have had. They'll be talking a little bit about what are your interests, why are you applying at this point in time, you know, is your postdoc coming to an end. They're probably going to ask, why are you interested in industry as opposed to academia? Those kinds of questions. And also to try to get they're trying to get a feel for, you know, your resume looked interesting. This gives them a little more opportunity to understand a little bit more what's in there to decide, yeah, this does kind of verify what I thought, so either I would like to or not continue with someone.
If I can add to that, when I have talked with candidates during a telephone interview, one of the things I do is ask very, very detailed questions. I'll find something, a few things on their CV and dig very, very deeply. The reason I do that, and the reason others do it as well, is to see how accurate your CV is. If you can't answer those questions, it does make me wonder how accurate the rest of the CV is. So you really should expect not only some general questions, why do you want to move into industry, et cetera, but you should also expect some very detailed questions too.
I have a question about first decision point. It was highlighted that this is based on the resume. What is the role of cover letter? Because usually we're supposed to send cover letter. What I've heard, the cover letter is the first impression.
Yeah. My experience is cover letters are used less than they used to be. I don't know if that's your experience, Libby, but I think it's part of the whole online process. Now, some online application systems allow you or invite you to do a cover letter. I would say a cover letter, I seldom see them anymore. If you're going to do a cover letter, it's certainly not going to hurt you, and it can help you because a cover letter can pull out or highlight a couple of things that maybe aren't quite as obvious on your resume or maybe aren't even specifically stated on your resume, so it's an opportunity to give a little bit more information. So it never hurts to do one. It also then enables you to present yourself in a little more detail.
Thank you. And I have a short second question. In case if there is a presentation on interview, always I supposed to be prepared for presentation and carry flash drive with short presentation and a long version, or usually it's I mean somebody will tell me that I should be prepared for presentation.
Yeah, I think if you should be prepared to do a presentation. However, one thing to keep in mind is, one presentation may be more effective at one company versus another, depending what the position is. So it may be two very different presentations, or it may be a presentation that you tweak. Yeah, it's always a good idea to bring it on your flash drive. I think most companies will have you send it, and then they'll already have it loaded onto their computer. So when you go to the presentation room, it just makes life that much easier. But I would recommend, yes, bring a copy on a flash drive.
And my question was, if company will tell me clearly before that I should be prepared for a presentation, or I might be surprised that somebody will ask me.
I don't think you would be surprised. We always let people know. That would be unfair to do it. Well, there may be some people who are into, you know, that kind of interviewing, but we don't. So you're always going to know.
Okay. Thank you very much.
And you should ask. If they don't say it, then you should ask.
Thank you.
I was wondering about if you're interviewing at one place, about giving that place information if you're interviewing elsewhere, like one of the companies that's similar to it, mm-hmm. and if you're asked about things like that or what the etiquette is in those situations.
Yeah. You're not required to bring it up, so I would suggest you don't have to bring it up. Now, there are times when it's beneficial to do that. If, for example, you have another offer or you're expecting another offer, so you think you may have a certain timeline, you can mention that to the second company or third company that you're interviewing with so that they know. Now, they may ask you what your timeline is as well, and so you can say, yes, I'm interviewing. I tend to be one more for openness in the process. So if you are interviewing and it comes up, say, yeah, I am interviewing at other companies.
A common question, and I've gotten this a lot during interviews I've had, people will ask, where else are you interviewing? I feel it's appropriate to generally describe the kinds of companies that you're also interviewing at, but not to name them specifically. The reason I say that is it can impair your negotiating ability later on if you do get an offer from a company. If they know that you're interviewing at a company that tends to have a higher pay scale, the current company may not want to get into a bidding war and may back out. So it can impair your ability to negotiate later on. However, answering all questions that you'd get from an interviewer is important. So how I've handled that in the past is I've said, well, I'm interviewing with a large pharmaceutical company up in the Northeast, and it's a position in regulatory affairs, or it's in clinical research. You know, give basic information, but too much detail can actually hurt you later on.
I agree with that. As far as giving the name of the company, there's no need to do that. Plus, remember, if you tell me that you're interviewing at other companies, that makes me think, so I'm not the only one that finds this candidate attractive. And so it does tell me a little bit more about you and that I have some competition.
I have three questions. The first question is, usually people had into a full informal interview and they were very satisfied if they think they will for further interview, but there's no further replies. So that it means, you know, how could we, like, based on previous experience and improve that?
Mm-hmm. So my understanding is sometimes you have an interview that you think went well, but then you don't hear anything
from the
company. First of all, that's kind of shame on the company in the sense of not getting back to a candidate that they brought on site. But I understand, I've had the experience myself, that companies don't always do that. So one thing you can do is follow up. I mentioned that earlier, to see what the process is. Hopefully they will then tell you, you know, we've selected someone else, or we don't think it's a good fit. You may also run into a situation where you just can't get an answer back from them. You can never get through to the person. They never send you a letter indicating their decision. Hopefully that won't be the case. But that's how I think you need to handle it, is it's okay to check back in to follow up to see where the process is at.
My second question is, for example, if your company have many opens online, is it possible, you know, sometimes they say, like, although there are many possibilities, you apply online, but it's better if you have friends that they are employee of your company. Does it mean that if I'm interested in your company, I have to make friends of your employees first?
No, that doesn't mean that. It does. I mean, that's the point of networking. If you do know people in the company, friends or acquaintances, whomever they may be, that can be a very positive thing because it can help get your resume in front of a hiring manager or give you some more information. Even if you do or don't have acquaintances or friends at the company, you're still going to want to apply. You're going to need to apply for the job. Doing both is fine. In fact, again, I recommend networking if you've got a network to utilize because it makes your job search that much more effective.
The third question is, and if I think I'm very qualified for one of the positions, but, you know, someone told me that, like, the company usually requires scientists should have, like, more publication, like more than 20 publications. Is it right?
I think the question is, you think you're qualified, but you understand they're looking for a larger publication record than you might have. It depends on the job, at least in my experience, but a publication record can be important. So that's why I think in the interview you have the opportunity to demonstrate your qualifications for the job. They may ask you about your publication record, and so you'll need to be able to respond to how you've published, why you've published, when you've published. But, you know, your record is going to be what it is. And I have seen some hiring managers who look very closely at that and have ruled out some candidates because they thought the publication record was weak or too short.
To add to that, there are a number of organizations that don't necessarily want a long publication record. What we do in industry is commercialize products. Unfortunately, we're not employed to write manuscripts. And I know of a number of situations where candidates were disqualified from active consideration because they appeared to be more interested in publishing than in actually working on a development team and getting a product candidate to market. So the qualifications that somebody is looking for are very diverse. It depends on the company. It depends on the position. Publication record may be a part of that, but as Eric said, even if you may not have as long a publication record as somebody is looking for, undoubtedly there are other aspects of your background that are equally attractive to a hiring manager. Make sure you focus on those.
Okay.
Is there a way to? Oh, there it is. Okay, got it. I put together a small chart of interviewing processes. I know a lot of people have questions about what can I expect when I go into MedImmune, when I go into Pfizer, when I go into Combinatorics, companies of different sizes, companies of different missions. What can you expect when you walk in the door? Interviewing processes are as diverse as the companies that have them. So what I've tried to illustrate here is something that might constitute a really tough interview, a challenging interview, and something that would be a little bit easier, something that's not quite so anxiety-provoking, kind of the two extremes, and then some general comments that go along with these. Most people ask about the duration of an interview. Interviews can be very, very short. If your hiring manager knows exactly who they're looking for, they know exactly the kinds of qualifications you need to have, you could have a half-day interview and walk out with a job offer. That's not as common anymore. A full-day interview is far more common. I myself have had two-day interviews where I've stayed overnight in a particular city and come back the next morning to answer questions for another round of interviewers. So be prepared for those kinds of extremes. They tend to run in the middle, though. About a day-long interview or most of a day is very, very common now. I want to reiterate another thing that Eric had mentioned is your preparation is key to how you're perceived when you come in the door. A great deal of effort has gone into arranging an interview schedule. Many people are involved. Salary time is involved. And so everyone is going to be expecting you to answer questions, be very prepared, know the position, know the company, in order to make the time that you have with them worthwhile. So preparation is really, really key. A lot of effort's gone into your presence there on that day. The more competitive a position is, the more likely you will have a split interview. Maybe you'll come in for a half day, and then a month later you'll come in for another, a second, what we call a second interview. Just a follow-up, possibly with different people, but sometimes the same interviewers are on the schedule. The point in doing this is that there are a lot of candidates. There is a big candidate pool, and oftentimes interviewers want to talk with you again. They may do this by phone, but often they'll bring you back into the company. A research presentation. We had a question earlier about the research presentation. You will be told, you'll know this ahead of time. It would be in no one's interest to have you come to a company and then say, oh, by the way, we want you to present. You wouldn't have slides. You wouldn't be prepared for that. Part of what they're looking at is your presentation skill. How well can you put slides together? How well can you speak to your slides? That's a critical point for scientists, and so people will be looking at this very, very critically. I have had interviews where I have not been asked to give a presentation. I think that occurs later in one's career, where you already have an established reputation of the kind of science you do, the kind of scientist you are, and your presentation skills. You've presented at numerous international meetings, and people know you. I would recommend for everyone to be prepared to cut your presentation down to a very short 15, possibly even 10 minutes. It's not uncommon when you are interviewing, especially if your presentation is at the end of the day, the interviews run long, and so you'll get to your presentation late in time. And so if you can get the interview back on track by perhaps cutting down some of the commentary that you may have given, that's often helpful for people. It also shows that you can be flexible in a newly developing and emergent situation, and you can roll with those punches. So it's definitely in your best interest to have a short, medium, and a long version, at least in your mind, so that you're prepared for that kind of emergent situation. The people who are likely to be on your interview schedule really runs the gamut. If you're in a small company, you might interview with everybody in the company. I've worked in very small companies in my past, and I've spoken with pretty much everybody before I came in the door. Larger companies, obviously, that's not going to be the case. You may have your hiring manager, their immediate supervisor, and maybe somebody from the lab in which you'll be working. 30 minutes, 45 minutes with each of those people. At larger companies, or if an interview is longer, like a two-day interview, you know, expect to be talking with more people from a very diverse background. You might talk with, people from clinical research, because they're interested in knowing how your basic science might affect them. How can we work together? The R&D part of a pharmaceutical or a biotech company, they often say that little ampersand in the middle is the bottleneck, you know, and people want to know that they can work with the scientists. So you'll have a diverse interviewing schedule. Definitely your immediate supervisor. You will definitely be talking with that person at length, usually hour and a half, possibly even more, possibly on multiple occasions. So expect follow-up phone calls. Expect other questions or to be brought back a second time. Length of the interview, again, probably 30 minutes for most people. That may stretch out to an hour, depending on how much time has been allotted. You know, if you have a plane to catch at 4 o'clock, you know, people may shorten the interview schedule somewhat. But be prepared for a pretty broad range of time that you may spend with any given person on the interview list. The environment. I have had interviews where multiple people have been in the same room, kind of shooting questions at the same time. Most of the time, they're one-on-one. When I'm interviewing a candidate, I have some specific questions. I want to learn about that person, and I'm not necessarily willing to share my time with other people, because I need to get some very specific pieces of information. It can be used as a tactic by companies to see how you work in a group situation and under pressure. But it's not as common as it once was. I do want to say something a little bit. I know I'm rushing through this so we can get to some questions. I do want to say something about personal interviewing styles. Do not expect your interviewers to be very good at that. That's not what they're hired to do, with the exception of folks in HR. That's not their role. they're a scientist or they're perhaps an executive, they're in some other part of the company, they do something different. So their questions might seem odd or not stated quite articulately. It's because that's not what they do for a living. Some people are very enthusiastic interviewers, and you will find those. They're interested in your science. They want to know what you've done. They want to know how you can apply that to their company and to their project teams, and they probably won't let you out of the door of their office because they're so excited about what you can provide to the company. Others will be less so. Others will be less so. It is not uncommon to have at least one or two people on your interview schedule who don't seem very friendly. This is an opportunity for you, though. Is that perceived unfriendliness, that hostility, is it just because they're nervous about interviewing? They have you sitting in their office. They don't know what questions to ask. They know they have to spend a half hour with you. What are they going to do? They start picking apart your CV. So it's not necessarily personal. It's not personal. Others do really want to challenge you. How does this candidate perform under pressure? One thing that you'll find in industry, it's a high-pressure situation. You'll have competing priorities all the time. You'll have people in your office or in your lab saying, I need you to work on my project right now because the deadline is tomorrow. People want to know how you handle that pressure. So do expect some pretty tough questions during the interview process. It's meant to see how do you handle those kinds of unusual circumstances, those high-pressure situations. I would also add the caveat that it's an opportunity for you to really determine, you know, you're going to be working with these people. If someone is unfriendly, is that just because they're nervous, or is it because that's their personality style? And you have to step back and say, you know, this could be a colleague. This could be a colleague. I could be facing this every day. So it's helpful to probe with that particular individual what the situation is. Lastly, I do get a lot of questions about what to do during mealtime. Depending on how long your interview is, you may go out to dinner with a group of people, almost certainly lunch, if it's a full day interview. But if you don't have to catch a plane to go back to your home location, you probably will go out to dinner with at least a few people. By no means should you feel this is a time to relax. People may say, gee, here comes the good part. You can let your hair down. We'll be casual. It'll be a relaxing dinner. You're still on an interview. You're still on an interview, and so you do want to be on your toes. Appropriate behavior at a nice restaurant, not imbibing too much because you're still going to be getting questions in an interview style. Should we open it up to questions about the interview process? Any questions on what you might face when you walk in the door? Do you want to move on to questions? Are they on this particular? I put together a list of questions that I've been asked in the past.
The length, or should the candidate ask the company what length they expect and things like that? I mean, I've heard different things from different areas for industry jobs, for example.
Yeah, I don't know if a length, there's a particular length. I keep on hearing from a lot of my colleagues who work in human resources areas that, you know, it should be a page or two. Mine's 11 pages. I get a lot of grief from my friends about that. But every time it goes in front of somebody, people say, wow, you've done a lot of work. You've done a lot of really important work. So in between that 2 pages and 11 pages, and I've even seen a resume that was 360 pages, that's over the top. It was a huge publication record, but it was still way over the top. Be succinct. the more I have to read, the harder it is. But don't shortchange yourself. I think some of the rules that are out there, make it one or two pages, I don't know if that can do justice to a person's background. So use your good judgment about what you think might work for a particular company, knowing that readers are busy, are really busy.
There is no set number, as Libby said, and no, don't call the company and ask them if they have a template or something like that. Just to reiterate what Libby said, your resume in the first scan doesn't get lots and lots of time, so the information needs to be easily accessible. So I would suggest avoid paragraphs and use bullets, for example. Give some thought to, if you're applying to an academic institution, that's probably going to be a different looking resume than if you're applying to a company. And so you should take some time. Again, what do you want them to see? What do they need to see? Don't blow it up. I would suggest one or two pages should be sufficient. Unless, you know, your publication record obviously adds extra pages. So I'm saying one or two pages to show your experience, qualifications for the job. The publication record is really additional to that.
What I've done here is I've put together some questions I've been asked in the past, thinking that they might be helpful for you. This is not an exclusive list. I'm sure there are hundreds of other questions that will pop up and that you'll probably see them. But these are tend to be very common questions, ones I've faced either more than once or, you know, were obvious for the positions I was applying to. I won't go through all of these since you have these available to you, but I did want to focus on a few of them, because they either are tough to answer or, you know, people feel uncomfortable with them. I would almost certainly gather that you will be asked why this company? Why are you choosing MedImmune? Why are you choosing Pfizer? Why are you choosing, pick a company? And your answer here will reflect the research that you've done. It is really not helpful to say, well, you know, you're in the area. You know, you're a local company. I would send you out the door pretty quickly. I want to make sure you want to do the work that I have on my desk, on my lab, that you're aligned with the mission that we have. So why this company? You know, why are you interested in us? Have an interesting answer. Have an interesting answer for that one. You'll definitely be asked about team behavior. We work in teams in industry. You won't be doing things on your own, separate from others. So do be prepared for that kind of team orientation question. I would suspect that you've worked a lot in teams within your academic careers. You know, a lot of updates among your lab mates, et cetera. So be prepared with some very specific examples of team behavior that you've demonstrated. It will be very, very important on the commercial side in industry. How your training will advance some of the drug candidates that we have in our company. That is a common question, and it is especially common for people coming directly from academia or from a government situation. They want to know that what you do can translate into the types of work that they do in their company. Basic science is something that we're all absolutely interested in, and it moves medicine in this country and around the world. But people want to know that you can actually make that translation from science and into a commercial arena. So be prepared for an interesting answer there and possibly with examples as well. Challenging team behavior. People, again, you'll get a lot of team questions. So having examples of where you've worked on challenging teams, how you've demonstrated the ability to work with challenging people is a theme that interviewers tend to ask of candidates along the way. An answer like, gee, I I get along with everybody. I wouldn't go there. That shows some naivete. You know, of course there are going to be people that are more challenging to work with. The best thing you can do is pull one of those examples out of your background and discuss it. Discuss what you learn from it. Discuss how you use that example to improve situations in the future with other challenging teams. That's a much better way to go than to say, gee, I'm not around tough people. You will find them in industry. Mark my words. Examples of something that you've failed at. This is a real opportunity for you. I think it's a question that makes people probably more nervous than anything else, but it is an opportunity for you to demonstrate how you overcame something. You know, the first part of the question, what you actually failed at, is only the beginning of the answer. The second half, which you need to supply, is the example of what you've learned from it and how you use that lesson in your life as you move forward. People really want to know that, you know, failures aren't going to be repeated. Let's see what else here. Again, worst person you've worked for, worst job. Again, it seems so negative. You don't want to go down a negative train of discussion. But use that as an opportunity to turn it into, gee, here's what I've learned from that particular situation or working with that particular individual. Oops. On the second page, it kind of continues with some of those kinds of questions. How do you handle stress? That question comes in many different forms, but it is a high-pressure situation in industry, and somebody is likely to ask you, what do you do to blow off steam? How do you work with people who perhaps aren't as science-driven, data-driven as you? How do you go about making decisions when there is so much dissension or differing opinions? People will want to know that you're able to be flexible. To be really flexible in high-stress, competing opinion situations. Another one on here that I would like to talk about current compensation. People do ask this with some frequency. It's best to avoid this question for later negotiating purposes. It's a question that does come up, but a comment like, "Yeah, I've thought about compensation, and I know that MedImmune has a competitive salary structure, and I'm sure that any offer that may be coming would be commensurate with my qualifications." Those are the ways you handle some of those tough personal money questions. Lastly, I just want to briefly comment about questions that over the years I learned to ask. It was very important that you find a good fit for you. This is not just a company interviewing you. As Eric has mentioned, this is an opportunity for you to determine, is this a good fit for me? Is this where I want to spend my intellectual capabilities? And so understanding why people are at that company. I always ask interviewers, what brought you to the company and why do you stay? And I'm very, very interested in hearing what they say. Some people have said, you know, I've got the world's greatest boss. They provide opportunities for me that I don't think I would have had elsewhere. Those are good answers. That's what you want to hear. What you don't want to hear is, you know, it was a local company and it's in the area and or we underwent a merger and I just stayed with the company. You know, that doesn't excite me. that's not really an attractive aspect of a company. So important to have that piece of information for your own personal decision making. What are the top three challenges associated with this position? People will never share with you some of the perhaps negative elements of the company that you're interviewing with. Now, when you ask them, what's it like to work at this company? It's great. It's absolutely great. I love it here. That's not overly helpful. What you want to know are, where are those challenges? If somebody says something like, and I've had this happen, well, your biggest challenge will be getting Dr. Smith to, talk with you for 5 minutes without yelling at you. That's information I want to know. It tells me a lot about the corporate environment. Likewise, you should do the same. Understand what opportunities and challenges await you at that company. Also, if selected for this position, what are the key objectives you'd want me to meet in the first 6 months? Pick a time frame, 3 months, 6 months, 12 months. This will give you a pretty good understanding of what you will be doing, what you will actually be doing. If the job description is somewhat vague, this is the question to really bring that out. You'll want to know what you're going to be doing and how you're going to be evaluated during your time there on that work. So, again, think of questions that you need to ask in a diplomatic way, certainly, but you need to elicit some information from the interviewers about what kind of company this is, what's the corporate culture is like, and asking questions at the end of an interview or during the interview is your opportunity to do that. Any questions? Eric, do you have some hot questions that you know of that tend to get asked?
This is a good list, and as Libby said, there are a ton of other questions that could be asked. My comment, though, was going to be a recommendation to you is, if you're going to be interviewing in the near future, I would take this list and put together an answer for every question on it. Now, you may not be asked all these questions, but you may, and if you haven't done a little preparation, you may find yourself unable to give a very convincing answer or an answer that demonstrates your capabilities. So in my experience is I'll take my list of questions that I expect may be asked, and I'll write out answers for them, and I'll review them so that I have it in my mind so you can pull it out when the question is asked. But that's what we mean by preparation. I really recommend that you spend some time doing that.
I know that the answer to all the list is depending what your situation and what company you're applying, but I would like to know or you can give us some examples about question, why do you want to join industry, and why don't you want to continue your career in the academic environment? I think for us, if we want to switch our career from the academic to the industry, we're going to expect to be asked those questions.
Oh, yes. By virtue of a postdoc, you've indicated that you've enjoyed the academic environment. The industrial environment is quite a bit different, and people would want to know what precipitated that shift. There are many people who will go on to lengthy and really productive careers in academia. Why would you want to leave that possibility and come into industry? It is a question that is asked, probably less so for people who have been in industry for a long time. Obviously, you know, they're already in industry, but if you've been in academia for a while, you'll get asked that question. Even a slight variation of that for people who have been at a company before. Why would you want to leave biologics and go into pharmaceuticals, or why would you want to leave medical devices and go to? So there are a number of different avenues. So if you're looking at a pharmaceutical company, it may have one flavor to it. If you're looking at a device company, it might have a slightly different twist. But people will want to know. That's a pretty big change to make. And why would you want to make it? And especially, why would you want to make it now?
I always ask that question of people coming out of postdocs or academia. The answer I usually get, I mean, there's no right answer to any of these questions, but the answer that I tend to get is that they're drawn to more applied science, and that they're eager to see their work result in something very specific. You know, maybe it's a drug going into the clinic, or hopefully a drug going on the market. That's the answer I tend to see, and that is a major difference between industry and academia. Most industrial or most companies don't do fundamental research anymore. They do applied research and applied development. Occasionally, I'll get the answer that they feel a need to make more money. And industry does pay more than academia in general. I'm okay with that answer, as long as I feel that they're not just about wanting to make more money, but that there's something else there. But I don't have a problem with that particular answer.
What is your favorite answer to this question?
Favorite answer to that question? I don't have a favorite. What I'm looking for is that they've thought through their decision and that they can explain to me why they want to come work in industry, first of all, at MedImmune, secondly, and that job specifically. Because those three are not the same thing. They're three different things. And so my favorite answer is one that convinces me that they know why they want to come to MedImmune and why they want to contribute to what we're doing.
I was wondering, how long is it typically, if you were to get an offer from somewhere that they expect you to start, or what's reasonable for asking them, I need more time, or things like that, if how they might perceive that, even if you want to work there, but you feel like I want to do a few things first and delay, something like that?
That's a negotiable element of your job offer. Often people will start in 2 weeks. I've known some people who have delayed for 3 or 4 months. I haven't heard of anybody delaying longer than that. Part of getting to a company quickly after an offer is made is a demonstration of your commitment. You know, if you were really excited about this job, you'd want to be there pretty quickly. Often, after leaving a postdoc or after leaving another company, a person does need perhaps a little bit of downtime, vacation, you know, whatever. But I wouldn't make it too long.
You're past the stage in your lives where you have to go backpack around Europe for 3 months. But companies want you there as quickly as they can get you there because they have work that needs to get done. So expect that. That being said, to Libby's point, if relocation's involved, it's going to take a little bit longer. If a family is involved, it may take a little bit longer. You may have planned some time off. So it is negotiable. I think the time frames usually are a month to 6 weeks. I've seen some that are 3 or 4 months. Companies don't tend to like that, but sometimes there's really no way out. And, you know, if the candidate's a good candidate, it's a tough job to fill. That may just be a compromise that a company makes. But don't be afraid to negotiate the point.
I have two questions. One is regard to the postdoc. It sounds like you kind of associate the postdoc with the academic path. But I know if you want to get a science position in industry, they usually look for a good publication record and also 2 years minimum postdoc. So is it true then that they still regard that as you're switching from academic to industry path if you've invested years in a postdoc?
Just to give you one example, I didn't postdoc. I had a number of job offers as I came out of graduate school. And at that point in time, pharmacokineticists were in such short supply, the industry was just pulling them in however they could. I think it is more typical to do a postdoc. I think especially if you are acquiring additional skill sets that have great meaning for the company, that will be easier. It can be more challenging and look a little more academic if it was just a continuation of personal interest that wouldn't necessarily benefit a company. The focus, and I think Eric mentioned this earlier, there's a huge candidate pool, and you want to make sure that any additional skills that you've acquired over time really are a benefit to the company. If they're not, you know, the postdoc won't be as high up on the criteria list for a hiring manager. Does that answer your question?
Well, I know when I was a graduate student, there were a lot of people, other people in my lab were pharmacokinetics, and they focused on that. And they got jobs right away after graduate school. They were hired. But it seems like people who took the biology route and the basic science route, there was always that push to do a postdoc. That's why I'm doing a postdoc right now, is to get that science level one or position in terms of being the manager of the lab and working on that. It's like you just couldn't get it right out of grad school. They look for 2 years, postdoc, publications, that kind of thing.
Go ahead.
I will say for Metamine, we definitely prefer a postdoc because it's different than when you're a grad student. I mean, there's more autonomy as a postdoc. You've taken your research skills to another level. So we do hire occasionally people right out of their doctoral program, but we normally prefer a postdoc. I think I would look at it a little differently than you suggested at the beginning of your question. Is I don't think we look at it so much as going from academia to industry. I mean, you may have always had the desire to be in industry. I think we tend to look at it more of going from one culture to another, because even if that was your desire all along, it's still a change. And so we still want to check into, you know, you haven't been in industry yet, what's driving you to want to pursue industry? So it's a little bit differently. I don't think, at least at MedImmune, that we look at postdocs as, oh, they're just coming out of academia. We really don't. We look at it as they're coming out of their further training, and now they're wanting to make this step into industry, so we want to make sure that the fit is right.
And is there anything you're looking for that's been accomplished during those years of the postdoc? Are you looking for, I mean, could you have the success in 2 years of a postdoc? Are you looking for 5 years, or?
We usually look at 2 or 3 years. I mean, 5 years tends to be on the longer side with regard to the people we hire, although we do have some that have 5 to 7 years of postdoc. 1 year seems a little short in the sense of what we think someone can develop by doing a postdoc.
Okay, and one last question is, none of these seem to be science-based. I was wondering if more of the science-based questions are going to be during the phone interview and then more of a personality assessment during the in-person interview, or is it 50-50 with the science questions, then 50 with the, you know, can you work in a group and that kind of thing when you meet in person?
You'll be asked questions about your scientific background. No question about that. And often that comes during the presentation, during the Q&A session after your presentation. You'll have follow-up questions. If your presentation is in the morning, you know, people will have the opportunity to ask you when you have interviews with them, aspects of your training and some of your experimentation and what the results mean, et cetera. So you definitely will be asked. The question list didn't include any scientific questions because I just assume you all could talk for hours about what you do and what you've accomplished within your postdoc setting. Definitely expect those, so. Mm-hmm.
So I have a question. You might have seen a lot of people make this transition from academia to industry. So usually what are the challenges they face? What are the things they don't anticipate? Like what are the differences between working in a, like, you know, as a postdoc as against in a research, like an industrial environment?
It's a good question. The question is, what are the biggest challenges in moving from a postdoc into an industry setting? I think when I left graduate school, I and went to my first position, I have to say I was really surprised at how large a product development team is and the number of disciplines on that team. I wanted to know why marketing was at the table. That just didn't seem possible to me. This is, you know, pharmaceuticals, that should be about science. What I learned very quickly was it takes a lot of people with a lot of different talent to get a product through the development cycle, through the registration cycle, and onto the market. So I think a big challenge that people have, part of that transition, is understanding who are all these people? What do they do, and how do I work with them? You know, how can our work together dovetail, not just on the personal interaction style sense, but also does the work that you do, does it affect what I do? And we need to be meeting or perhaps having teleconferences and so forth. So I think one of the challenges is understanding who all the players are, who does what, how decisions are made. Companies have very different ways of making decisions. Sometimes you'll be involved with them. Sometimes they're made at levels that are up in the stratosphere. So understanding that you're probably not walking into, you definitely aren't walking into an autonomous situation, and it is a team sport, and knowing that you'll have to identify people quickly and work with them is very, very important.
If I can just finish on that one. Some other things are, again, as I mentioned earlier, it's going to be it's applied science, and so you may find yourself thinking, wow, it wouldn't be interesting to know that. And yeah, it might be interesting to know that, but there may need to be the time or the resources to pursue a certain path that might be of interest to you. Another thing is you may be working on a project for a couple of years, you love it, it's your baby, and the company makes a business decision that we're not going down that path anymore, and boom, you're done. You are done with that project, and you'll be reassigned to another project. And then it is a very fast-paced, you know, industry is there. These are for-profit organizations, and so they're interested in the progress and the work that's going to move candidates through the pipeline to the market. And it's important to remember that, you know, it's not just about the money. Please don't take it that way. But ultimately, it is moving projects through and molecules through the pipeline to commercialization.
In all this, how important is the science, like the scientist who's doing the work, like, and how much does it contribute to the real decision, like, or is it, you know what I'm trying to say, like, you're part of a bigger team, so where do you stand in the team, like, what's your contribution to it, like?
Right. If I understand where you're going, You contribute a very important component to the company. You know, the scientific education that you've acquired will be critical to the success of the organization. And you are one of many people. There are people who have spent an equal amount of time perfecting their expertise in marketing, in pharmacology, in regulatory affairs, in a whole range of disciplines. So your work will affect a company. And to Eric's point, people want to make sure that you can take your skill sets and very quickly turn that around into meaningful contributions to the company. As most of you know, it takes anywhere from, you know, 5 to 15, 16, 17 years to get a drug candidate through the development process and onto the market. So any one aspect, you know, can take a long time. As we can shorten those timelines, the better off a company is. So your contribution will be felt. It's especially true for smaller companies where you have more visibility and people are relying on you.
I have a question about the follow-up after an interview. Let's say you go to a company, you feel like you had a good interview, you've been talking to people, and then what should you do after? Should you take the contact information from the hiring manager and then contact them after? How can you convince them after you've been there and let's say did a good job, but they have a pile of other people that were at least as good as you. Some of them came from the industry, you know, they already have the experience that you don't because you come from academia. But you want to convince them that they should contact you back. So what do you think is the best way?
You've highlighted the extreme importance of being articulate and on point during your interview, because in many cases it's the only shot you'll have. Sometimes you will have follow-up possibilities. Sometimes people give you a business card and say, gee, if you have any questions after the interview, please call me. I'm happy to field a question. That happens, and I myself have fielded questions for potential candidates. I'd be really careful about too much follow-up. You know, some looks good. It looks enthusiastic. It looks like you're committed. That's a great thing. You don't want that to go over into being a pest. Again, during that interview, you really want to demonstrate why you are a unique person for this particular role, this particular company, in order to make that so clear. When that stack later on that they're going through, they say, oh, yes, I remember her. She was spot on so many of the things that we do. You want to leave that impression that, wow, they just need to hire you right now.
Normally, there isn't a stack of people who've come in for interviews. There's usually a little bitty pile of 3 to 5. So if you've come in for an interview, you're most likely in that 3 to 5. But it is a good point. Following up is okay, but you do not want to be a pest, as Libby said. So, you know, if you're looking for a suggestion, one thing you want to do in the interview then is say, where are you in the process? Oh, we're just starting. Okay, that gives you an idea that it's going to be a little while till they interview everybody. Or we're right in the middle. Or, well, you're the last candidate that we're interviewing, actually, and we hope to make a decision pretty soon. So that's one way to gauge it before you even walk out the door. Then from there, you know how much time to give it. Do you give it a week, 2 weeks, a day? I would not just give it a day. But so then based on that, if you haven't heard anything, then it is okay to follow up with the hiring manager. You can re-express your interest, ask if they need to know anything else about you, and ask them, just curious if, you know, when you might be making your decision. And then, but you do need to have some patience, as difficult as that can be in this kind of a scenario, to let the process go through. And if you still haven't heard anything, you can either then decide, I'm probably not the one, and it's unfortunate that they didn't let me know that, or you might try one more time. But I don't think I would suggest following up more than a couple of times.
Do you expect the candidates to have an extensive knowledge about your drugs? Do you ask them questions like, what do you know about this drug, and does it make a difference to you when you select your candidate?
I definitely expect candidates to know a lot about our portfolio. It's part of demonstrating the research that you've done about this company and this job. So there's a lot of information out there, websites, et cetera, press releases, news wires, et cetera. You definitely want to demonstrate your knowledge of a company's portfolio. I have gotten questions from candidates, what kind of drugs do you develop here? That it demonstrates they didn't put any effort after flying them all the way across the country, you know, and spending a lot of money and time with an interview. They didn't do their background work. And I wouldn't be able to expect someone like that to answer, you know, how could you fit into this company? They wouldn't know. Absolutely know quite a bit about, as much as you can about their portfolio.
Quick question. Is it okay to ask who are the guys that will interview you, you know? Then you know the guys, and you can check the background, where they did their PhD, find some common. So is it appropriate? You know, it's kind of tricky here.
You'll normally receive an interview schedule before you come on.
So you know the
guys. So you know who the people are and what their titles are. Yeah.
Gotcha. Thank you.
You may not know their background. You know, if they have a PhD in whatever discipline, and it's perfectly acceptable to ask, you know, how did you get here, what's your academic training, and what brought you to this spot in your career.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks.
So we're going to move on to a quick mock interview. They gave me the list of the questions that you guys all have. I don't know which questions they're going to ask me, so I have 20 some questions. I'm going to pretend and channel my inner postdoc. It's probably going to be more similar to a phone interview because I'm going to keep my notes in front of me. That's the joy of a phone interview, is that you get to keep all the notes in front of you and be in your slippers to make sure that you can address every single point. In a typical on-site interview, I would never pull out my notes and go, oh, I wanted to talk about car law. Right? I would never do that in an on-site. But on a phone interview, I can have these notes in front of me, and you should have them in front of you. So these guys are going to ask me a series of two, maybe three questions, and then I'm going to ask you guys to critique how I did. This is why I'm doing it, not you. So we only have one mic, so we'll have to pass it back.
Well, Laura, you have a great resume. This is a great body of work, and I'm very, very impressed. Why would you be interested in our company?
So your company does a lot of really nice work and some good patient advocacy work as well. So not only is it working from the research and development side, but also trying to push things into the community to make sure that the community understands what's happening in the R&D side. I find that having that is a really nice mix, and it gives the opportunity for the consumer to understand the products that are behind it. And you also do a lot of work with the R&D, phenomenal work pushing in new drugs in the immunology department, but also in some new cancer therapies as well. So you have a very diverse portfolio, you have a very nice patient advocacy group, and so between these two groups, I think it makes it a really nice mix for the type of personality that I have.
Laura, you said a couple of times that we do, you feel that we do great work and great research. What do you mean by great? What appeals to you so much about the work we're doing here?
This is hard when you don't know exactly which company. I've done a lot of research, not only into things that you have on your website, but looking at also some of your patent applications and things that you've done. You use very interesting new technologies. You have produced new things and have gone with current technologies that are on the market, not only that are developed in-house, but developed out-of-house, such as, say, quantum dots that you're preparing and pushing through. And so you're not afraid to look to the future in technology. You're not stuck within with a rut of still doing NMR when there is new technologies out there that can be available. And I think my background really is able to adapt to that kind of things from both being a biophysicist by training and a geneticist by a postdoc, that I've looked to see how I can adapt myself, and that I think would benefit your company as you adapt to new technologies as well.
Now, how would your training specifically benefit our company? How do you propose to use some of the work that you did, you know, when you got your postdoc in genetics? How would that apply?
Well, my postdoc started out in genetics, but then quickly moved back into biochemistry, biophysical techniques, which it seems you guys are working on as well. I've noticed some work currently on fluorescent technologies. I have a lot of experience in stop flow kinetics and fluorescent techniques to understand kinetics. I used a very interesting model of looking at DNA cleavage using fluorescent models instead of traditional gel assays. And so looking outside the box and being able to use that fluorescent technology and then to study cleavage in real time versus in static time. And so as you move forward in some of your oncology therapies looking at real-time assays, I hope to be able to use these fluorescent assays that I used in real time as a postdoc and a graduate student into your type of company.
Lori, we work in a lot of teams here at MedImmune. So tell me about a specific time when you were a member of a team, either as a team member or maybe a team leader, where the team was struggling to move forward, meet its objectives for whatever the reason might be. So tell me, you know, what was that situation and what were you able to do to help the team get back on track?
So as a graduate student, I had a challenging principal investigator. She often made more work in the lab than was necessary. So I took the team lead within the graduate students and the postdocs and the technicians to start develop timelines and time management priorities to make sure that we're meeting our boss's needs as well as our own needs so that we could get all the work done in the priorities that we felt that we all needed to go. For example, we had a very interesting NMR project that required the entire lab to be involved. The technicians needed to express and purify the protein. The undergraduates were using it to then test the activity of the protein, and then my boss and I were coordinating the NMR schedule to take time points every 3 hours. So my job within this team was to coordinate the undergraduates and the postdocs and the technicians to make sure that the protein was done on time, to make that sure that the assays were done on time, and that the boss and I were communicating up and down the chain to make sure that all the time points got done in the small NMR window that we had. So it was a challenging team in the fact that it was a very short time period. You only got NMR time for 24 hours every 2 months. So you had a very short window. So you had to work as a team but have someone leading it to make sure that everybody was getting their job done so that when that window opened, you had everything in the tube and you were ready to go. All right, we'll do one more.
Laura, can you tell me a little bit more specifically about how did you engage these different members of the team to take this new approach? You know, what were maybe some of the hurdles you ran into in engaging them?
So one of the biggest hurdles was we worked a lot with undergraduates who weren't in the lab as much as a graduate student or a technician. And so one of the biggest hurdles we had to deal with is time management, to make sure that we could do experiments when they could be in the lab, and if they couldn't be in the lab, that there was a proper chain of command. So we used our whiteboard a lot. We had a whiteboard in the common area, and we would set up, Kevin's going to be here on this time, Kevin's going to do this part of the project. Natalie's going to be here on this time, she's going to do this part of the project. And if Kevin has to leave early, Natalie has to know. So the only way we could do it was to communicate things and have things up where everyone could see it. Otherwise, everything would have fallen apart, and no one would have put in the IPTG. So what do you guys think? How'd I do? Remember, I've been out of the lab for 3 years now. Anything specific? Let's ask our experts.
I think you did well. I think it's worthwhile remembering you will be asked a lot of questions of, give me an example of, and having those. And Lori did. She could very crisply roll those out. And it gave me confidence as an interviewer that, in fact, she had accomplished that. So I thought that was a good interchange. Also good eye contact and a level of enthusiasm. You can kind of see some power coming through her voice that as an interviewer, I would want to see.
Also, I hope you noticed how we would ask a question and then would drill down before we would leave a question so that we could get more information from her. So that gets back to being prepared. Obviously, Lori was, you know, caught off guard in the sense of, you know, what company, what job. But interviewers will drill down like that. So you can either make your answer very thorough and succinct without rambling up front, and they may choose not to drill down, or they may drill down some more. So you'll need to be ready for that. You can't sit back and think, whew, okay, I answered that question. They may not be ready to move on. Secondly, one thing I wanted to point out about Lori's answer to my, so how did you get this team engaged? One thing that I didn't hear was how she interacted with the individuals. What did she communicate to them? She talked about the whiteboard that they set up for scheduling and such. I was also interested to hear, how did she interact with them? How did she get them to buy in to this approach that they were doing? How did she communicate the need to them for what they were doing? So, again, I point that out because that's what people will be looking for, is these are, you know, when you hear, how did you interact with a team? Okay, think interpersonal. That's important to that question.
It's really difficult to come up with the answers if you haven't prepared ahead of time. you end up stammering more as an interviewer. And a lot of times we forget some of the things that have happened to us in the times we have worked in a team. Because our team structure in academics, and really here at the NIH, it's an academic structure, is very different than the team structure. So in, just want to plug a couple of more things that are coming up in this, not that we're done right now, but unless next month in January is the giving a talk to an industry audience. That goes back to what you were asking earlier. We're going to have someone come in and tell you, how do you develop a talk that's going to win over industry? And then in February, the VP of Management and Operations of Wyeth Vaccines is going to be giving a talk on how to transition to team-based environments in industry. So you'll want to be you want to make sure you're starting to plug your calendars for some of these extra things that are coming along. Does anyone else want to try a question at the mic?
Okay, almost as important as it is to have the right answers, it would be to answer in the right way. So I would like you to tell me about what you pay attention in the body language when someone is answering to a question.
Body language is important. I look for eye contact. I look for ease, in my guest chair when I'm interviewing somebody. Are they fidgeting, looking around? It would tell me that they're probably not as comfortable in this environment. Granted, interviews are stressful situations, so a little of that is, to be expected. But if somebody can't look me in the eye and give me an answer, I would be concerned.
I agree with all that. I just want to make the point is there aren't necessarily right answers to the interview questions. Now, some answers would be obviously the wrong answer to give, but there are different ways to approach different situations. And so a lot of times it may not be exactly what you did. It may be how you did it or why you did it. So don't get too hung up on thinking, is this the right answer? But rather, am I providing the information that I think they're looking for in a given question?
Can you talk a little bit about the negative question? What do you expect when you ask, what are your weaknesses? What are the things you don't like to do? What do you think that are, the least? How do you behave? What do you really expect of those questions? Why are they important, and what do you like to hear?
I personally don't like the "what are your weaknesses" question because I'm not sure I'm really getting a true answer to that. So I don't ask that question. But when I do ask a question about, and Libby had that one here about, give me an example of something you failed at, or give me an example of a time you set out to do something and it didn't work out the way you had hoped. I mean, that could be viewed as a negative question because something went wrong, you didn't accomplish something. What I'm looking for there is, okay, what happened? What went wrong? So I'm looking for a willingness of somebody to say, yeah, I failed at something. I never believe anyone. They said, well, I've never had that experience. So I'm also then looking for, what did you learn from the experience? I would do it differently, and here's why. Or based on that experience, the next time I ran into that, I did something different. That's what I'm looking for, is the learnings and the honesty about, yeah, I make mistakes, but here's how I deal with them.
I'll share one of mine with you. I have been asked this question many, many times. I think it's common for inexperienced interviewers to ask, not somebody who has a great deal of expertise in this type of thing. When I first joined industry, and Eric alluded to this earlier, when projects are terminated, they're gone, and you have put a great deal of time and effort, all your intellectual time into this, and it can be devastating. And so I have in the past used that as a weakness of mine. I become very attached to my projects. I put my heart and soul into them. What I've learned from that is that it's a business. This is a business about science. And there are times when you absolutely want to kill a drug candidate because it's unsafe, it's not meeting the criteria we set out for it. So what I take away from my experience in getting too attached to molecules is there are many other projects that are really interesting. So and I share that with you because it is a failing. You know, I get too attached. I've offered a lesson, what I learned from that, and what I do differently in the future. And that tells the interviewer that, yep, everybody fails, but here's how we move on, and move on in a constructive way.
If they ask, like, give me an example about the most challenging team you've worked with and what did you do specifically. So if I don't have, like, a specific example about science, but about, like, personal experience outside of my science work, is it okay to give, like, an example? If, like, we work in a community and we have to do any project, then...
Yes, it is. Yeah. Because those skills and that experience applies across all sorts of situations. It's not just because it's a scientific situation.
So I'll ask one more question here. A lot of people come into my office and ask, Lori, when should I bring up that I have two of us looking for jobs? When, if, how would I, what's your recommendations there?
I would not bring it up in the first interview. In fact, I would probably not bring it up until you had an offer in hand from the company. I would hope that your significant other is also applying for jobs and applying at the same company if there are jobs there that they think are of interest to them. We do get that situation where we're hiring someone and they have a spouse or a significant other or whatever the situation is. And, you know, we will take a look, and we have hired both at times, and other times we have not. It's okay to bring it up. You don't want to put it in terms of you can't have me unless you take both of us. Now, that might be the case if it's a relocation and, you know, you can't move unless you know if you and your significant other don't want to move unless you both have jobs. So you'll have to work that out. But to me, I would suggest wait until you're farther down the line and there's an offer on the table to have that discussion.
I agree with waiting for an offer. The competition for some jobs is pretty tough. And one never knows if you will get an offer. So sometimes it's worrying about something before you need to worry about it. So I too wait.
So one of the questions is, what will you do if you don't get this position? So if you don't get this job, what is your future plan? So how to answer?
You mean after you've gone home and sobbed the night away? So, I would hope that you're not just looking at one position, first of all. I think you need to be looking at various positions and give yourself choices. If you end up not being the successful candidate, you can try. It sometimes just works. You could talk to the hiring manager and say, you know, would you mind telling me why? That's always a little bit touchy because managers sometimes aren't comfortable giving that information to a candidate. But you can try. I've done that before, and I got the feedback. And it was feedback that was accurate, but that I hadn't realized about the way I had interviewed for that particular job. So I took that to heart and paid attention in my next interviews about that. So that was beneficial to me. I think what you do is try to learn and understand why you were unsuccessful in that and apply that to your continued job search. But again, don't put all your eggs in one basket. You need to be looking at as many applicable positions as you can.
So what I wanted to know is, so it is a question that the interviewer asks you, so what is your plan if you are not offered? So if the position is not offered to you?
So I think it's the same question. I think it's the same answer. Is I'm looking at multiple positions, I'm looking at multiple companies, I'm not shutting any doors at this point. I think you have one last question?
Yes, it's along the lines of what you were just talking about, looking for multiple positions. Where should you find these jobs? Should you go to the actual company websites, or there's Monster, Yahoo, or Hot Jobs? Like, what are your recommendations?
All the above. Okay. So we often say that for that, I wouldn't rely on Monster. I wouldn't rely on Craigslist. A lot of places are putting things on Craigslist. I would actually, the most accurate one is the company websites themselves. So you should be spending a lot of time spinning out which companies best fit the type of science that you do, and then on a weekly basis going to see if there's any new job openings at those particular companies. That's not to say that Monster and Craigslist and all the rest of those don't have good stuff, but the companies have the end-all be-all of what's available.
Can I ask one
and networking question? What's that?
How much jobs that you actually advertise on the company website are actually still open? I mean, how does it go? You know, sometimes companies, you know, they advertise a job, but they actually already look for people from probably other sources. So what is the percentage? If you just look at what is on the website, is it a good place to find jobs, or all the jobs are already almost gone?
It's a good place. You know, some jobs are, we haven't even started interviewing. I'm talking about jobs that are on the website. Some we haven't started interviewing, some we're in the middle of, and some we're really at the offer stage. So we do take them down as soon as they're filled. By that meaning we have an acceptance of the offer, not that the person has started. So if it's still up there, apply for it. It may be that it's, you know, we're right at that point where we haven't quite taken it down, but usually the job is still going to be open and we're still going to be looking.
Yeah, but what would you suggest would be the way to know that, you know, that MedImmune is actually going to advertise a job that might be a good fit in 2 weeks? I mean, what would be the best way for us to get that information?
Look at the website on a regular basis. That's how you're going to know. Because, we post all of our jobs. So that's how you, and I would say that for any company. Just keep your eye on the companies that you're interested in and look on a regular basis.
A number of the positions I've had actually resulted from phone calls of former colleagues asking me if I'd be interested in a position in their company. Often the people you network with, your friends, your associates, will know if there's a shortage in their department and they're likely to add headcount. You know, if you have kind of an inside scoop that situation is occurring, you're ahead of the game. It will go onto the website, but you'll have some advance notice of it. So I'm a big advocate of networking, keeping your networks up, just to see what other people are doing and to hear about some of these things in advance.
So I'd like to take a moment to thank our speakers today. I hope you all got everything out of this that you came for. So let's give them a hand.
Thank you for your accolades. But I wanted to bring up one other topic. I was kind of surprised it hasn't come up, and that's the question of visas for those who are not American citizens. It's a tough area to work in, as I'm sure many of you know. Many companies, I can say for MedImmune, we do sponsor visas on a regular basis. Many companies do. Some may not. Some may choose that they don't want the expense or the challenge of doing that. But the point I wanted to bring up is don't lead with the visa question. We've had candidates at some time will lead with that, and I'm left with the impression that they're more interested in getting a visa than coming to work for MedImmune. Also, companies by legislation are not supposed to consider the visa status of a candidate before actually making a job offer. So if you lead with the visa question or bring it up too soon, it may put the employer in an uncomfortable position. It doesn't mean that they're not going to consider you. It just may put them in an uncomfortable position. On applications these days, as you've probably seen, it asks, are you authorized to work in the U.S.? And are you going to need support for a visa at some time in the future? You know, we ask that just to have that information. It's okay to ask a company, do you sponsor employees for visas? That allows them to say yes or no. I think in biotech and pharma, most are going to say yes because we're looking for the best candidates. Leave it at that. When it comes down to a job offer, then you're going to get into that conversation. What kind of visa do you have? What does it look like that we can do? How long might it take? That sort of thing. So the important point there is then if you get a job offer and you need a visa, then work with the company on obtaining that visa. Most companies pay for that. MedImmune pays for that. We have an immigration attorney that we utilize for all of our hires. So that's okay. The second thing is then if you're hired and you get your work visa, an H-1B or an O-1 or whatever it might be, a TN if you're from Canada, whatever it might be, don't get over-eager your first day about, okay, when can we apply for my green card? Okay, most companies want to give a chance to see how an employee works out. We have kind of a rule of thumb. We'll wait kind of maybe 6 months to a year to make sure it's a good fit both ways. And we do sponsor employees for green cards. And we understand that that's important to our employees who are in that position. So my advice is really we understand it's important, but use a little circumspection around the area of visas so that the focus is on hiring you. Because then the visa, if the company wants you, then we'll work out the visa thing. Some work out very easily. We had one last year where we couldn't hire the person for 8 months because of the timing of H-1B visas. And we will do that sometimes if that's the person we really want. So, again, be patient in that area as well. The company will work with you. But, again, let that process kind of follow the path it needs to follow.
All right, so everybody's got everything they need to know about interviews. Remember, I think it's January 29th will be talks, giving a talk for industry. So it's on the Career Advancement Toolkit website off of www.training.nih.gov. If you need to do mock interviews, if you're ready to go and you want a mock interview, you can make an appointment with me or one of the career counselors, and we'll be happy to do mock interviews with you so that you're prepared better than I was when you walk in the door. And with that, everybody have a great afternoon, and we'll see you around. Next week's the holiday party.